Hello and welcome to The Conversation. I'm Beth Ann Kozlovich. This week, President Trump signed a resolution allowing states to withhold federal Title X funds from full-service family planning centers. The move nullifies an Obama order meant to safeguard those centers from states seeking to stop abortion, largely by targeting Planned Parenthood. This week, too, the organization's regional head of the Great Northwest in Hawaii is back in Honolulu. Chris Charbonneau came into our studio yesterday, and we talked about the Trump resolution and its effect on states' power to control her organization.
Well, we were grateful to President Obama that he had written these protections in to begin with. It meant that President Trump would have to remove them if he wanted to. That's the act he's taken. It means that in states where family planning providers like Planned Parenthood are being attacked, that states would have no barrier to attempting to defund Planned Parenthood for various discriminatory reasons, as opposed to not doing the job or committing fraud. Usually those are the standards by which providers are measured. And we're hoping that that is not the case in many states. It's clearly not a problem for us here in Hawaii. And Planned Parenthood is not going to be defunded here in Hawaii because of the political will here. But the most recent work only makes it possible for states who have an inclination to go after Planned Parenthood in a new way. It's not a problem in what we consider the blue states, but it is a big problem in what we consider vulnerable or red states. And so it's possible that people could say, we're just not going to let Planned Parenthood do family planning in those states. We won't lose our money, which used to be the penalty for a state that did that, if we don't allow it. So I would assume that in those states, there will be a tremendous amount of court action to try to protect Planned Parenthood.
Which seems to be more state money lost and less of an ability to be able to deliver services to women in those states who may need them and who will have to then go elsewhere.
Well, the real ridiculousness about this game that's being played is that the people who are hurt by it are low-income women who need contraception. And I think as vast majorities of the community believe that low-income folks having help getting access to contraception is a really fine idea, that this is just the kind of public policy we don't elect anyone to go do.
Because this has been so couched in an abortion conversation, how do you change that conversation now when so clearly it's been moved in that direction so long and so strongly?
Mm-hmm. Well, we have to just keep repeating that the funds we're talking about are not about abortion. The funds we're talking about are contraceptive services. People who use these funds are prevented from using them for abortion services. That, in fact, works. The family planning entities are all audited on that basis every year. And for 40 years, there have not been cases of family planning providers trying to use birth control money for abortion services. So we just need to say this is about birth control over and over again. And basically, women are being used as pawns in a political struggle.
When you talk about offering services, that leads us into a conversation about SB 501,
yep,
which is currently in yet another incarnation, in which some of the language has been changed to not use the word abortion at all, but to talk about, you know, pregnancy-related services. Mm-hmm. What do you make of that?
I think that SB 501, which is the bill regulating limited service pregnancy centers, needs to be thought of as a broad consumer protection bill. Basically, the goal here is to ensure that these organizations that purport to be helping women are really mostly there to mislead people out of their ability to get an abortion in a timely fashion. They're there to propagandize against that particular choice. And I think as long as these organizations are required to uphold those sorts of standards, then we will be fine with it. They're going to go into conference committee and work out any details that need working out on that. But we're hopeful that the bill will come out to be something that's really of service to the public.
You mentioned earlier that in blue states like ours, you don't feel a great deal of threat. Do you find it ironic, though, that we are still having these niggling discussions over this kind of language in a state like ours?
I actually am a little bit surprised. It's not a mystery what these organizations are there to do. These organizations want women who are pregnant to decide to carry those pregnancies to term. And there is history in the movement that created these organizations that they would lower themselves to misleading tactics. They would advertise themselves as pregnancy advisory. Sometimes they put themselves in phone books under the words abortion services and lure people in that way. And I always just use the framework, if you're really doing something right for people, if you're really doing something just for people, you don't need to lie about what that is. And if you're not, then you might have to lure people in. And so I think that that having the normal kind of protection one would have for any other service makes sense, and it makes sense for the legislature to support that. If you were going into a hospital and you were trying to get your tonsils removed, and someone said, you know, must come here for tonsillectomy, and then when you got there, they tried to talk you out of having something done about your tonsils, you certainly would feel misled and deceived. There would be all kinds of complaints about something like that. And so this is just that. It's not okay to force people to do what you want them to do by misleading them about what your purposes are.
The conversation that cleaves along religious lines is what you're alluding to. Mm-hmm. Is that line ever going to be able to be breached? Is there any way of being able to make a cogent argument, or are we simply in for this forever?
Well, I believe there's a tremendously cogent argument. If you have women who are really undecided, acts of kindness and support that help someone carry a pregnancy to term could be an incredible gift to somebody. Saying, we will be there for you 24/7 for the next 18 years of that child's life as a religious community or whatever else you happen to be, that would be a very powerful supportive message. The we're going to be there for 2 weeks to take a pregnancy test for you but not give you the results until it's too late to do something about it, that's not kind, and that's not just, and it's not spiritual, and it's not religious. And so that is what this bill is designed to guard against, and we wouldn't need to guard against it if it didn't exist.
How do you think Hawaii is doing in the real concern for reproductive rights?
I think Hawaii is phenomenal in terms of the concern of the people and the legislature and the willingness to cooperate, insurance companies helping, people just all getting together around what's smart to do. In fact, Washington State just passed the bill that allows 12 months of contraception in a single visit, inspired by Hawaii, who did it last year as the first state in the country. That made sense, not to make it more difficult to get contraception for the women who need to use it. And Hawaii has the potential to become the very best state for women and women's health in the country. And I think that should be all of our collective goal.
What do you think stands in our way of being the very best? What comes next?
I think we just write down our agenda together, have some discussions with various community members about what is it that we could put in place to make the environment the most supportive for people who are getting planning in advance, making sure that they don't get ill. We create an infrastructure that supports the people who do it, and off we go. I think the willingness, the political understanding in Hawaii is the best in the nation. And I think very little stands in our way of actually getting that done. I'm incredibly hopeful about the future of this state.
Including some of the religious arguments that we keep hearing year to year.
We keep hearing them. And I think that, as I said, there are ways for the religious community to be incredibly helpful and supportive about some of this. It will not mean that they will be able to determine what people who are not of their faith do. And it will not mean that they'll be able to control the people in their own church. But the arguments certainly can be made. And, if you win over the hearts and minds of someone, they might see the world your way. That's always an option. Getting in the way to prevent people from exercising their own rights, that's not the path.
I want to thank you so much for stopping in.
Thank you so much, Beth Ann, for having me.
Chris Charbonneau is the CEO of Planned Parenthood of the Great Northwest and the Hawaiian Islands. It's the regional group that operates 27 health centers in Alaska, Hawaii, Idaho, and Western Washington, and provides medical services and sexuality education to more than 80,000 women, men, and young people each year. The resolution signed by President Trump yesterday allows states to restrict federal Title X funds to family planning centers.
This is The Conversation on statewide member-supported Hawaii Public Radio. Coming up in the show, creating a musical connection between images and formal composition. But first, your quiz.
No matter how skilled you are in the water, 9.3 miles is a long distance to swim. The Kalohe Channel separating Lanai and Molokai is exactly that length and is infamous for its strong winds and choppy seas. As mentioned in previous quizzes, the seas of this channel are so rough that they've swallowed several vessels throughout history, including the British ship Alderman Wood. That's why it's so impressive when people actually swim the channel for recreation. In 1978, a man and a woman duo first completed this feat, and they are the focus of today's quiz. So can you tell us the names of the first two individuals to ever swim across the Kalohe Channel? Call us at 941-3689 or 877-941-3689 if you know the answer.
Support for The Conversation comes from the HPR Local Talk Show Fund, which helps Hawaii Public Radio sustain and grow its locally produced talk shows. Mahalo to contributors Inter-Island Solar Supply, Kaiser Permanente, and Hastings and Pleadwell, a communication company.
Many of today's young composers of concert music grew up under the influence of movie music, in part because some of the most memorable orchestral compositions of recent decades have been associated with images seen on film. Michael Thomas Fumai is a young composer and UH instructor whose composition Manukian Murals has just earned him an ASCAP award. He's with us in our studio. Good morning, Michael.
Good morning.
There's a great many composers have linked visuals to sound, and in your case, you chose these really beautiful murals of old Hawaii, you know, kind of contact era Hawaii. What was behind that particular choice?
Well, the commissioning ensemble, the Dolce Suono Ensemble, wanted me to write a piece that connected to Hawaii, and it took me several months to figure out what I was going to write about. And I had met with a donor through the UH Foundation, and this donor was a collector of Manukian's artwork.
Yeah.
And I was introduced to it, and I immediately was struck by the colors, the originality of this artist. And as I found out a little bit more about his life, I found that he had a bit of a tragic life, but he was a young artist just like me. He died when he was 27 years old. Armin Manukian, an Armenian-born artist, and immediately I felt this connection with what he was doing, and I thought, no, this is artwork that should be known everywhere, not just in Hawaii, but yeah. it's an artist I've never heard before, and I've been living here for quite a bit of time. So I thought if I could write a piece that could express and get more people to know about his artwork, I think that would be a good thing for Hawaii.
It's lovely work, and it's images that you might not know the name, but it's images that a lot of us might have seen just, you know, around town. But it's also the thing that jumps out at you, I think, at first, is a distinctive color palette, very warm, warm variety of colors, just as a musician has a musical palette.
Yeah, and that's something that really struck me the first time, is that these colors are really pastel-looking. They're mm-hmm. vibrant. But the images themselves, they speak to all the senses. Mm-hmm. You can smell, you can touch, you can hear. All the ancient Hawaii that he envisioned, and that's something very rare I get from any kind of artwork. So mm-hmm. that's what drew me to it.
The people really look like people, don't they?
They do.
And
so
that,
the fruits as well.
That in itself is an accomplishment.
Yes.
So then you chose for this piece, you chose the instrumentation of cello, flute, and piano, and that in itself offers some challenges and some opportunities as well.
Yeah, it's not a very common ensemble. Usually a piano trio is composed of a violin, cello, and piano. So the substitution of the flute in the ensemble created a lot of challenges, but a lot of opportunities as well to explore different combinations of sound with string instruments and wind instruments.
Mm-hmm. And wind instruments can have that, you know, can maybe have that human quality more readily in some ways. I mean, you get the sound of breath in there.
Yeah, and that really humanizes the composition and the performance, and it really brings some of the vitality that Manoukian brought to his work.
Let's hear a brief sample of this. Is from Manoukian Murals. You've actually got all three instruments in roughly the same range in that particular passage, don't you?
Yeah, and that's the first movement called Red Sails, and it is a very busy painting. You have this canoe at the center with vibrant red sails, and on the beach you have these Polynesian gentlemen, very handsome looking, very athletic built, and they're foraging for fruit mm-hmm. in this kind of paradise. And so I wanted to create that sense of finding things, and so it was very busy texture-wise.
There's the instruments are almost kind of chasing one another around.
Yeah, as like a treasure hunt, as one would try to find a hidden Easter egg.
Yeah.
And chase after it. That's the way the music unfolds.
Well, that's an interesting way to look at it, and you know that there you have to sort of come up with a process in creating a composition like this for that translation from what you see to what you're going to hear. And it doesn't have to be strictly illustrative. It just needs to be inspired by what you've seen, right?
That's right. There's nothing. There's not a musical idea that represents a fruit.
Yeah, yeah.
It's just the idea of creating a kind of atmosphere of that painting.
Yeah, because literal just wouldn't work. I mean, it wouldn't necessarily be clear to the listener, would it?
No, and it's not that important to me for the listener to get, oh, that's that phrase, and that phrase means that. It's about creating a journey.
Yeah. Where are you going next with your work, do you think?
Well, in terms of projects, I can't speak to any of them right now because they're all in the planning stages, but I have several chamber works in the works and a very large orchestra piece. Mm. Again, it's all in the planning stages, but it's all very exciting, all with a connection to Hawaii.
And an orchestral piece has got to be quite a departure from something like what we just heard.
Yes, it's a different beast. It's a larger ensemble, and it's more like painting in bold colors mm-hmm. rather than detail.
Well, sounds pretty interesting. Thanks a lot.
Thank you.
Michael Thomas Fumai is a lecturer at the Manoa Department of Music, who has been awarded a 2017 ASCAP Foundation Young Composer Award. And you can learn more about him and hear samples of his work on our Hawaii Conversation Facebook page.
Among all of this legislative session's appointment confirmation hearings, one is notably missing. As of yesterday, the governor's appointee to the Public Utilities Commission has not been scheduled. Civil Beat reporter Chad Blair has the reality check. Hey there.
Hey, and good Friday to you, Beth Ann.
You too. Now, it's not as if this appointee is a particular surprise. I mean, we've known about this since last June. So what explanation have you received for the lack of confirmation hearing, at least as of yesterday, for Tom Gorick?
Yeah, we haven't got a satisfactory explanation. I checked the list of all the governor's appointees. There's hundreds of them every session, and only one other had yet to be scheduled a confirmation hearing. And remember, the legislature wraps up May 4th. So we couldn't get a solid answer from the Senate, from President Ron Cochi, from Senator Roz Baker, whose committee Gorick will have to go before. But think about this. Gorick is actually already on the PUC. He is a commissioner. There are only three. And what one has to wonder is if something political is involved here, because his tenure on the PUC, as you know, has been controversial, primarily related to the NextEra deal that fell through to purchase Hawaiian Electric.
But regardless, it disadvantages what the PUC is able to do if, in fact, you know, this were to be the situation that he's not necessarily confirmed.
That's right. And, you know, even if the committee, Baker's committee, voted against him, in other words, he didn't get a majority of the votes, it would still go to the full floor for a vote. If he does not prevail there, Gorick would actually have to step down by the first week of May, and that would leave a vacancy. Remember, there's only three members, three commissioners. That would be remain two. So they would, if they were was to be a disagreement, there would be no tiebreaker. Additionally, the governor would also have to pick somebody else to serve again on an interim basis until the Senate decides to come back in session and hear that appointee.
Chad, so there's no word at all whether or not they're going to schedule a hearing between now and, say, the 1st of May?
They have said they are going to do that. That's coming from the Senate leadership. They have not said what day that is. I just checked the Capitol website just a few minutes ago. Nothing yet has been said, but the promise is coming from Senate leadership that they at least will hear the Gorick confirmation. We'll see how it works out. We'll definitely be covering it.
And seeing if they honor that promise.
Exactly.
Have a good weekend and a happy Easter. We'll talk to you next week.
Thanks, Beth Ann.
Chad Blair joins us from Civil Beat periodically for a reality check. It's a Friday, and as we always like to do, we're going to take a look at what's happening in our news department and what we can expect to hear next week, which is in some ways a shortened week. Bill Dorman, HBR's news director.
Yes, it's true. We have a pledge drive coming next week. So the
I
news.
That. It,
well, it's true. It'll be coming. And the news staff turning an eye to some fundraising, but also keeping a watch on the news itself, including this coming week, some of the doings of Congresswoman Tulsi Gabbard. Now, you know, she's been having some town meetings, including one on the Big Island. Got another one coming up tomorrow here in Oahu over in Kailua. And we can expect this, as with some of the others, a little combination of local issues, some questions about Syria. Wayne Yoshioka is going to be going to that. He's also going to get an outside political perspective on all of this, on how some of not just her local issues, but also the whole Syria doings are playing locally.
A lot of people will be listening for that. There's been a lot of controversy around her and those town hall meetings.
It's true. So it'll be an interesting one to see how that goes over on Windward side.
While we're talking about controversy, we have been hearing reports about Korea's nuclear tests and what that might mean for Hawaii.
Yeah, a lot of focus right now in North Korea, understandably so. Saturday is the birthday of North Korea's founder Kim Il-sung, grandfather of Kim Jong-un, and it would be his 105th birthday and a national holiday, major national holiday in North Korea. A lot of speculation that may lead to whether a missile launch, engine test, some combination of something of that. But meanwhile, South Korea is in the midst of a political campaign. Former President Park Geun-hye has been removed from office, is on trial. The election for her successor, little more than 3 weeks away. A lot of threads to this, and some of them actually do tie to Hawaii. Not just about defense. This is also about the economy. And South Korea, not only as a source of visitors to Hawaii, but increasingly as a source of investment capital here in Hawaii. A lot of the development projects in the Ala Moana area, backed with Korean funding. Mirae Asset is a growing player in the hospitality industry here. So the politics of South Korea are actually a point of great interest to a lot of folks here in Hawaii.
And so, part of the politics of our place right here.
It's true.
What about music? We need a little music to leaven this a bit.
I tell you, Ladysmith Black Mambazo, South African vocal harmony group. You may know them best for performing with Paul Simon on the mm-hmm. Graceland album, but so much more. They were sort of virtually the house band for Nelson Mandela for a while. He took them when he got his Nobel Prize. They're appearing in town. They did a couple of songs for us up in the Atherton studio, and along with an interview with Dave Lawrence, and we'll be hearing all of that on a couple of segments of All Things Considered this afternoon.
Got to watch some of that yesterday through my window, and it was just wonderful to start the day listening to them, and tonight to be able to hear them on ATC. Thanks.
A little bit of magic.
Lots of magic, actually. And every Friday, we take a look at what's going on in our news department with HPR's news director, Bill Dorman. Another Friday doing around these parts is checking in with your comments and your feedback. And after last Friday's story on the bike sharing program coming to Honolulu, Andrea DaCosta tweeted us, Hawaii doesn't want or need them if they plan to use Thomas Square. Everything the city and state does will fail until they do right by Kanaka Maoli.
Following Wednesday's interview about the Navy's innovative approach to tackling sexual violence, Justin Hahn wrote this on our Facebook page. I do wonder why there aren't more positive strengths-based interventions for sexual assault or sexual misconduct. Like these men, mostly, are doing these things because they feel it's the most effective way to meet their needs for sex or companionship or connection or whatever. It's a toxic analog to real relationships, but it's basically what they know. Why not teach men how to actually interact positively with women so they aren't left with these awful alternatives?
Also on Facebook, Brandy Sens had this to say, I quit my DOD job at Joint Base Pearl Harbor Hickam because there's so much of it everywhere. They do not help. I am not the only one.
Tanya Narvaez Bush left this comment on Facebook. Our homeless issues are not for amateurs. We have housing issues affecting people who are employed, and I see how hard it is for someone making $70,000 plus to rent a place. Unfortunately, they can't even dream about buying their house. Yet I see those empty houses around my house. They're not even used as vacation rentals. These are houses that sit empty for over a decade. Our state should have a way to regulate this. We thank you for your feedback, and if you have a comment about what you hear on the show, you can email us at talkback@hawaiipublicradio.org, reach out via social media on Facebook or Twitter, or call our talkback line, 792-8217.
Sometimes a story hits close to home. HPR Evening Concert host Judy Anderson was on her customary run through Kakaako Park when she was chased and mauled by dogs. She was bitten, scratched, and bruised, but we're glad to say she's okay. It has been previously reported that dogs have been roaming the park, but until yesterday, the Hawaiian Humane Society was hamstrung in its ability to respond. It needed permission from the Hawaii Community Development Authority. So what makes the society's response going forward different from the past? We got an explanation from Harold Hahn of the Hawaiian Humane Society.
Well, we usually respond after the fact, where we get a report referred from the Honolulu Police Department or sheriffs, and we try once a week to make inspections because we know it's an area which needs to be monitored. The issue around this is that we don't have jurisdiction in Kakaako Waterfront Park.
It's a state park, and so presumably that would be state jurisdiction with the sheriff being responsible.
Correct. You know, HCDA is the current agency under the state that it falls under. So what we do, though, is for the past year and a half, we've been doing outreach, some enforcement, education, along with the governor's office in the park. But it still is an issue because it's not so much of a dog issue as it is a people issue. The dogs are a peripheral issue to the root cause.
Right. You're talking about people who are living freely there, people who are homeless, who have taken up camp around and in the park and who happen to have dogs and who don't have them on leashes or corralled in any sort of way. A lot of the people who are seeing this, many of them are dog lovers. It's hard for them to understand how there can't be something there to protect people who are using the park. What do you tell them to do?
We can offer some suggestions to people who utilize or go into parks and whatnot where they may come across unknown dogs or other animals. You know, realize that we're not saying that this will prevent you from getting bitten, but any object you have, a collapsible, a compact umbrella, you can carry that with you. Anything, you know, dogs are, you know, especially when there are a number of dogs, they're pack animals, so they have a prey drive, so they're going to chase something that's moving, whether it be a bicycle, someone running. And this is not a unique situation, you know, not only at Kakaako Park, but there are other areas like the bike path by Nimitz Viaduct and whatnot. So, you know, an air horn, like they take to football games, also can serve as a deterrent. You know, if you do come across dogs and you are running, I can only make a recommendation. It's not any guarantee, but, you know, they're going to chase you if you run. And that's just kind of like what dogs do.
Which kind of thwarts the whole purpose of going for a run in Kakaako Park, right? Or any other park where you might find it. Now, you mentioned that you've been working with the governor's office and trying to let them understand what it is they're looking at with the dog problem as well as the people problem.
Right.
But right now, at least the dog problem seems not to be well addressed. Our staffer said that, you know, she was trying to talk to the sheriff, who gave her a very blasé attitude about this. Like, yeah, we know it's been reported, but no sense of any real concern that, you know, this was happening and frankly, you know, had also happened to her. Very different from the response that she got from, for example, HPD.
Right. So, you know, that being said, you know, over the past year and a half, we have taken about 8 or 9 dogs out of that park. Yesterday, we met with the HCDA, representatives from the governor's office, Honolulu Police Department community policing team. We all went out to Kakaako Park with 3 of my officers. And, you know, we need permission to operate in that park, which we got yesterday. So we managed to get 6 dogs out of the park that were running stray. We issued warnings. Now, HCDA also has a team that goes out twice a week, and they do administrative park rule warnings, which I think, from my understanding, if they get 4 warnings, they get trespassed from the park. So it's a collaborative effort that isn't a one-answer thing. It's going to take like an overall collaborative, holistic approach to solving the issue in the park. But I think we've made great headway starting yesterday, and we're going to come up with a plan.
One of the things that we hear continually is that it always seems to be a situation where somebody gets hurt before an action is taken, that we don't really look at this with enough prevention in our vision. It's more reactionary. Did you feel at all that that was the case with Kaka'ako Park? Because clearly you are getting phone calls about what's going on in that park and other places.
Right. I know it is proactive because I know they have a regular scheduled issuing of warnings and education twice a week, and they go out there. So I don't think it's so much as that as, you know, working together, not just one agency, because, of course, we provide the support with, you know, how we get the animals, transport the animals, which they don't have. So it's going to take us, HCDA, Honolulu Police Department, Community Policing Team, and, you know, members of the governor's office and whatnot to proactively address the problem. But like I said, we don't have, up until yesterday, we don't have jurisdiction in that park.
So this has been a journey for you, too, in being able to do something to help address the problem. But it's just taken it to get to this point before that happened. Obviously, we can't go back in time. But from this point forward, then, you'll be able to go into the park and take dogs out after a number of warnings?
Well, it depends. So dogs, you know, they're considered property under state law. So it just would be like if a person living in the park had a tent or a TV or a bicycle or a moped. So you have to be really cognizant of people's rights, everyone's rights. If there's violations such as strays prohibited or the leash law, no city and county dog tag license, dog bites, or, you know, that nature, which there are ordinances, we can take enforcement. If there's stray dogs in the park and no owner is around, even if the dog is tied up or in a kennel or cage and there's no owner around, we can also remove those dogs from the park.
It's tough for a lot of people to hear this because there are many people who love dogs but also know that they can be dangerous.
Right.
And clearly in this situation, we're seeing both sides of that story, including with our staffer who, in fact, is a dog lover and was shocked at how this happened and never expected it to happen. And that seems to be part of the issue, too, that when you're out and about doing something that may be your normal activity, like a run in the park, that these days you're going to have to be pretty cognizant of not only the people around you, but also of the animals.
Yes.
All right, Harold. Thank you.
Thank you.
Harold Hahn oversees the field services team for the Hawaiian Humane Society and is responsible for the organization's rescues and investigations. He's also a former officer with the Honolulu Police Department.
This morning's backyard quiz, we set out to cross the Kalohe Channel from Lana'i to Molokai. The channel is roughly 9.3 miles long and has a maximum depth of about 540 feet. It's infamous for strong winds, choppy seas, and a history of sinking ships. In 1978, the first successful attempt at swimming the treacherous channel was carried out by a man and woman duo. Following their crossing, no other swimmers were able to replicate that feat until 1989. Today, we asked if you could tell us their names. They are Bob Justman and Judy Pollack. And nobody got that today, but that's today's quiz. If you've got a quiz, you can send it to talkback@hawaiipublicradio.org.
Support for the Backyard Quiz comes from Achieve 3000, a literacy program used by Hawaii students in grades 2 through 12, offering home edition with parent support in 19 languages. Achieve3000.com.
How do we go about designing a sustainable future? It's a shared goal of any number of disciplines, but those goals have to be translated into practical solutions, and that's where events like the Building Voices Design Competition come in. The competition asks participants to concentrate on housing for all, food autonomy, resource independence, community-centered mobility, healthy citizens. Results will be announced on Earth Day, and Kathy Ho Shar, director of the University of Hawaii's Community Design Center, is on hand to tell us more. Thanks for coming in, Kathy.
Thanks for having me.
You might think of a design competition was about pretty design. This is a lot more to do with practical design, isn't it?
Right. It's really about problems that Hawaii is facing, and generating a set of visuals and prototypes that we can see here in Hawaii.
What kind of problems?
What kind of problems? Well, we establish a set of problems by listening to the community, our students, our faculty, the professionals, and the community at large. And the problems that they came up with were things like traffic, affordable housing, homelessness, the idea that we have a lot of coastlines and we have sea level rise, we have climate change. So we gathered all of those problems and initiated a competition to our local designers and global designers, asking them to offer a set of solutions.
Just taking the city of Honolulu as an example, a lot of the city came about before things like coastal, tsunami inundation zones, for example, were considered, right?
Right.
There's a lot of the city that's within an inundation zone.
Right. We have a lot of important investments in our low-lying areas. One of the things that we are incorporating into the symposium on April 22nd at the state capitol is a workshop explicitly looking at Waikiki as an area that's highly vulnerable to sea level rise.
Mm-hmm. And obviously we've invested a great deal of not just money but human capital in areas that are extremely vulnerable. But how do you turn back something like that? You know, how do you move away from something where we've made that much of a commitment of resources?
Right. Well, those are really good questions, and I don't think we have solutions to them. But what we're trying to do is to gather together the people who will be the creative problem solvers, the doers, the designers, who will in the next 5 to 10 years initiate some of the steps to see where we go.
Do you think there's greater or hope for greater communication between designers and implementers, if you will?
Oh, absolutely. You know, I think that's what the School of Architecture is trying to promote through the symposium and competition, is to bring the design community explicitly to the center of our state government and to engage not just the design community, but the engineers, the contractors, the developers, the policy leaders, the policy writers, the legislators, all of those people who will together generate an agenda or a course of action to address some of these problems.
Because when you look at some of the problems and sort of find yourself wondering how they came about, it does seem that some of them at least were exacerbated by a lack of communication between design and policy implementation. Do you agree?
Right. I think everyone was operating in their silos.
Yeah.
And this is an attempt to break those down.
Well, silos are sort of one of the flaws of our society, right? We do tend to stick with our own and within our own discipline, and maybe we've sort of lost some of our skills about communicating cross disciplines. Do you think that's a trend that's changing a little bit?
Oh, absolutely. You know, I think if you take a look at pedagogically what's being taught at the university and how people work in the profession, it's much more about orchestration, about working in groups, about collaborating, about integration of different disciplines. So I absolutely think that that's where everyone as a whole is moving.
And it sort of has to move pretty quickly, doesn't it?
It does. It does. We seem to be at a critical point where we need to work with each other in order to address, it just seems paramount now, right? All of these issues are at a critical point.
Yeah. Do you think there's sufficient, widespread awareness of that on the policymaking side among elected officials, for example?
I can't speak on their behalf.
I would
think that's on the agenda, but I think maybe there are just not enough opportunities or platforms or methodologies to integrate all of these different people. Maybe the infrastructure is not there yet for the design community or designers to communicate with the policymakers or the legislators. The opportunity exists, but maybe there's not a clear sense of how we would do that.
Yeah.
And maybe that will come up on Saturday.
Well, you also cite affordable housing as one of the issues, and of course that's been something that's it almost seems as if efforts in that regard have stalled for a number of reasons, but that's a huge design challenge aside from anything else, isn't it?
Right, right. And it's, you know, I think one of the panels that we have that addresses affordable housing is to break it open that it's something that affects all of us. It's not a small constituent, the cost of living affordable housing on one extreme, you know, has resulted in some part with our homelessness. And to the broader audience, you know, everyone's dealing with the cost of living.
That it isn't simply the a low income issue.
Right, right. And we have Jesse Wu coming in from HUD to talk about the demographics and statistics that shows that people with degrees, with children, four-person families, would fall under the affordable housing category.
Of course, we have, you know, specific challenges in a state that's composed of different islands.
Mm-hmm.
And also where we just, you know, particularly on Oahu, there's a sense that we're just kind of running out of room. So I guess it becomes an issue of how to make maximum use of the limited space available, yeah?
Right. So there, you know, I think there has been a lot of progress on the end. You know, in the last year, the city revised ordinances to allow people to build these accessory dwelling units. You know, I think now people are running into issues with sewer infrastructure. So we will be talking about that at the symposium. There's also the issue of how do we build density in a way that still maintains a pedestrian-friendly, a person at the scale at which people still feel that Hawaii is still a comfortable place to be.
Yeah.
Right? There's a lot of, I think, maybe anxiety over how that looks, what that placemaking exercise will feel like to people who are accustomed to a certain feeling here.
And yet it as we said earlier, that it isn't so much an aesthetic challenge as it is a pragmatic one.
Right. That in this, you know, in developing our urban areas or developing our non-urban areas, that it's not aesthetic. There's a lot that has to deal with energy, resources, infrastructure, placemaking, planning and policy. Right. As far as the design community, we're not just looking at it as an aesthetic exercise.
Well, there's clearly a lot to be taken into account. Thanks very much for talking with us.
Thank you.
Kathy Ho-Shar is an adjunct assistant professor and director of the University of Hawaii Community Design Center. The results of the Building Voices Design Competition will be announced at the Hawaii State Capitol on Earth Day, April 22nd.
Support for The Conversation comes from the HPR Local Talk Show Fund, which helps Hawaii Public Radio sustain and grow its locally produced talk shows. Mahalo to contributors, locations, Noheia Gallery, and Straub Medical Center.
There are a lot of different activities going on throughout our state, and Morning Edition host and colleague Derek Malama joins us for a look at some events going on in our community that might be a little under the radar. Today, for example, there's a free event, a health and wellness fair for families in Kapolei.
Yes, that's happening tomorrow. You know, as the second city continues to grow, so does the amount of new families in Kapolei and Makakilo. And they must also deal with long commutes, time that could be devoted to raising their kids. The Kapolei Keiki Wellness Day is designed to bring service providers and community resources together in one-stop shop for families who might not know about these services. It's from 9 a.m. to noon in the Kapolei High School gym tomorrow.
Kapolei Keiki Wellness Day.
Yes.
And that's a free event. Thanks.
Oh, yes, it is.
And you can celebrate the culture of Pacific Islanders tomorrow on Hawaii Island.
Yes, Pacific Islander Heritage Day celebrates the unique traditional culture of Hawaii. This free community event will include various demonstrations, hands-on crafts, games, music displays, and more. It's from 10 a.m. to 3 p.m. tomorrow at the Pu'u Kohola Heiau National Historic Site in Kauai High.
That's a beautiful part of the island, too.
Oh, yes.
On Easter Sunday, you can hunt for more than just eggs.
I know. This is an interesting one. It's at Salt at our Kaka'ako. They welcome Pokemon trainers, children, and their families for an Easter egg and Pokemon hunt from 1 to 5 p.m. For Pokemon Go players and fans, lures will be dropped every 30 minutes at Salt at Pokestops during the entire event. I've never done this myself, but I'm sure this is
just
interesting
to
someone. Attendees can also enjoy an Easter egg hunt for prizes. A registration begins at 1 p.m., and a DJ will be spinning music, and there will also be Pokemon-themed activities on Easter Sunday.
I got to admit, Derek, this makes me feel a little bit out of touch because I barely know what a Pokemon is.
I know. No, me too. No, you're not alone, Chris.
Well, I'm glad to hear that. This is one of those things where you walk around with your cell phone. And,
right. I've seen it on TV. And, yeah.
Well,
the kids know about it, though.
The kids know
about
it. The kids. And this is an opportunity for people like us to learn more.
Right.
Thanks so much, Derek.
You're welcome.
Derek Malama joins the conversation at this point in our program every day to take a closer look at events in our community that might be going on under the radar. You can always find out more on our website, hawaiipublicradio.org.
And with that, we come to the end of this week, but we'll be back on Monday. How to provide for child abuse victims is the work of the Hawaii State Chapter of Children's Justice Centers. We'll talk to them.
And an exhibit at Temple Emmanuel will explore the German roots of Zionism.
In the meantime, we'd like to hear from you, and you can call our talkback line to leave us your comments. Our number is 808-792-8217, or you can email us at talkback@hawaiipublicradio.org. Post comments on Facebook, or you can tweet us at HI Conversation or at BKOZHPR.
And if you want to hear today's show again, get another past show, or links to more information, go to the Conversation page on the HPR website, hawaiipublicradio.org. Our executive producer is Beth Ann Kozlovich.
Lillian Song produces the program. Ryan Finnerty and Amber Kahn are our production assistants.
And the Backyard Quiz theme was written for us by John DeMello. I'm Chris Vandercook.
I'm Beth Ann Kozlovich. See you on Monday when we pick up the conversation.